Let's go. Here we go now. Hello, my name is Rebecca Tapp, and this is the DNA of Purpose podcast, where we explore purpose as a part of who we already are. We showcase all inspiring stories of the most purpose-driven people on the planet with the intention of giving you the tools to step into the potential of who you were always born to be. After all, it's in your DNA. DNA. Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast. Now, I'm going to give you all a little bit of a warning. I'm a little bit croaky today. I've been battling a little bit of a cold this week, but I do have some exciting news with my croaky voice. I was only joking with a friend the other day about the fact that my personal brand and of course, this podcast is something that has evolved out loud and in public. What I mean by that is when you choose to use your voice and be seen in your purpose, you need to get comfortable with stepping into process over perfect. And sometimes that means going through brand transitions while in full view of your audience. Today is a milestone because here I am at another junction. For those of you who've been following my journey, you will know that I've been a part of the Future Crunch tribe for many years. However, in the last 2 months, I have thrown my hat into the ring and become the CEO, aka the Chief Executive Optimist, working alongside our incredible co-founders, Dr. Angus Harvey and Tane Hunter. This is not only exciting for me, but it's great news for this podcast because the DNA of Purpose podcast will be the first podcast to sit underneath the Future Crunch media brand. And just like all things Future Crunch, our focus will be on igniting intelligent optimism with, in the case of this podcast, purpose as the baseline. At Future Crunch, our ethos has always been that if we want to change the story of the human race in the 21st century, we have to change the stories that we tell ourselves. To put my own personal spin on that, I believe that if we are unable to create a vision for a better future through storytelling, art, design, and business, or through technology, science, economics, or social theory, then we can't make the decisions to create that future. And it's in those decisions that we unlock our DNA of purpose. So with that in mind, this podcast is evolving again, and we are taking it up a level. We will, of course, continue having mind-blowing conversations with the most purpose-driven humans on the planet, but our focus will be in looking at the trends, the tools, and the information that is available to us today that enables us to paint a more optimistic future for the people and the planet. The Future Crunch mission will be echoed in every conversation that we have, and that is to foster intelligent, optimistic thinking about the future and to empower people to contribute to it. Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast, brought to you by Future Crunch. That brings me to today's guest. Tim Duggan is a new media entrepreneur who has co-founded several digital media ventures, most notably Junkie Media, Australia's leading millennials digital publisher. In today's episode, Tim and I unpacked his brand new book, Cult Status, How to Build a Business People Adore. Why is that? Because today's consumers have changed, and the businesses that form around them are principled, purposeful, and creative. The next generation of entrepreneurs thinks differently, and Cult Status will show you how you can too. Tim believes that enough has been written about huge cult brands founded last century, Nike, Apple, and Red Bull. Instead, he asks this: what will the cult companies of tomorrow look like? Who is amassing the kind of passionate community that gives them the best chance of getting through difficult times to build long-term sustainable success? You can see why I had to have Tim on the podcast.
Tim, it is so lovely to have you in the studio with me today. Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast.
Thanks, Rebecca. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's so much fun, you know, after the last year, actually talking to someone face-to-face just gives me so much joy.
Oh, my God. And I've spent the last year doing Zoom podcasts and Zoom interviews, and they're nice, but there's no replacement for looking someone in the eye and sitting down and getting someone's energy that you can't really get through a computer.
That's exactly it. And I think it does translate. So I'm so excited to have you here and to dive into a subject that we are both super passionate about. Now, as a starting point today, I'd love it if you could walk our listeners through your professional experience over the last two decades with a core focus on how your purpose has unfolded on that journey?
Great question. Great opening question. Because purpose is something that I almost didn't realize what I was doing until I looked back and reflected on it. I started my career as a music journalist for Rolling Stone originally when I was about 19 years old. I watched Almost Famous, the movie, and I loved that kid in there. And I was like, I'm going to do what that kid's doing.
Yeah.
And at the time, I'd gone straight out of school into advertising agencies. And I decided I didn't want to kind of just jump on that conveyor belt of life, which for me was kind of going to school, going to university, starting work as a grad in a company and just working your way up. That just did not excite me. That kind of, I almost rebelled against that. So I went straight from school into the mailroom of an ad agency, which was amazing job. I learned so much, but halfway through, a couple of years into it, I was like, yeah, I kind of like this. I feel like I've learned from it.
Yeah.
But do I want to be doing this for my entire life?
This is not my dharma.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's kind of moments where you can get enough out of something and then realize that the time has come to leave. And luckily I was only 19 or 20 in those kind of very early years. And I realized I want to become a writer. So I badgered the editor of Rolling Stone and said, I want to write for you. I was like a 19, 20 year old kid, had hardly ever written, didn't know anything about the way the world worked really, but she took a chance on me and she gave me kind of like a 50 word album review to do. And I spent, you know, hours and days and weeks kind of like perfecting 50 words and then sent it off to her. The whole time, as soon as I sent the email, I just kind of assumed that she was going to send it back and say, you can't write. Who do you think you are? What are you doing? and then surprisingly, she would write back and be like, this is good. Here's another review to do.
But I mean, what a powerful question. Who do you think you are? You obviously could answer that question in some capacity to even have the certainty to go, you know what? I'm gonna show up for this opportunity.
Yeah, I think I answered it publicly, but not privately.
Yeah.
So publicly I'd send it off and be like, yeah, of course I can write. And then privately I would like, oh, this is the worst thing anyone has ever written. I'm going to be found out as soon as she reads this.
Yeah. And that, I'm a fraud.
Yeah. Yeah. And that kind of, that feeling is something that does still pop its head up every now and again. Hope now it's kind of a lesser feeling. It's when I, you know, hand my book in, there's probably like a 10% that's like, is this any good? Does anyone care about this? And now there's, thankfully, an 80-90% that says, no, have faith and confidence, this is a good thing.
Yeah, I think it sits in the ego versus contribution piece. I think as any kind of creator or influencer or anyone owning their voice, whether that be as a leader, an entrepreneur, in whatever capacity, you have those moments where you're like, am I going to let that ego-driven fear take over, or am I going to realize that what I have to offer is actually about being in service to the world?
Completely. And it's healthy. And it's, I think if you didn't have that, you would probably just become completely arrogant and your work would be kind of shit in the end if you thought it was the bee's knees, everything that you ever did.
Yeah.
So then I started writing for Rolling Stone and I realized I just loved writing. And I did as much of it as I could. I became a freelance journalist. I wrote for the Sunday Telegraph and had a column in there and just did lots of stuff that was really interesting for me. And I started putting on events as well on the side. And I grew up gay and came out when I was 19 or 20.
Yep.
And I started putting on events for the gay and lesbian community and realizing that I loved bringing people together. And that was like one of my first discoveries of my purpose. I didn't know it at the time. I thought I just loved getting people together and the feeling that came from that and the power that came from getting 1,000 people all in a room together. And, you know, of course, there's an ego part to that because you brought them into this room.
I am the king.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's also just this power that comes from collective action that's bigger than just yourself.
Totally. There's that group energy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I imagine particularly at that time as well, because you were creating, as you would say, and we'll talk about it more in a minute, but you were creating an altar for people from the same community to come together in a joyful way where they could share their own experiences in life.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's exactly it. And I didn't know it at the time. I didn't have the language to say that's an altar, or the language to say my purpose is bringing people together because I love the power of community. It just was something that I started following, and I just started doing more and more of it. So I had this events kind of business on the side, and then I had all my writing. And then when I was about 24, 25, I decided to combine those two things together and launch my first online community, which is called Same Same, which was a national gay and lesbian community. And I launched that with some friends of mine who had started their own community called In The Mix, which was a dance music website that started in around the early 2000s.
I remember In The Mix well.
Yes, yes. Long may it rain. An amazing example of probably one of the first really local Australian online communities, like before Facebook, before Twitter, before anything else when you think of online now. In The Mix had that. And I saw that and was like, well, why doesn't something like this exist for my community at the time? So co-founded Same Same with them in 2005 or 2006. And then that journey of then bringing a community online and then bringing them to life in the real world, that then became what really excited me. And it kind of combined some of my passions, which was writing and creating content, and the passion also for bringing people together who just happened to be online. But almost our point and our existence was kind of to drive people offline. So we kind of existed to try and get people to go to events and to get people to go and meet in real life. So Same Same ran for a few years. And then as a company, we realized that we wanted to be, we wanted more, and we saw there was a bit of a shift happening. So we launched a website called Junkie in 2013. And then within 6 months, that became our biggest website. It was this kind of side project, really, that just overtook the entire company.
Yeah.
And then Junkie was named Media Brand of the Year in the first year. We renamed the company Junkie Media, and then we launched a bunch of other titles like Punky a few years later and AWOL, which is a partnership with Qantas, and that became Junkie Media.
Yeah. What a ride.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice to look back and reflect on it, but at the time it's quite, I wouldn't say haphazard. It's more you just follow where the interests and passions lie, and then
it's like follow the breadcrumbs.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. You don't consciously realize that you're doing it. I'd love to say that the career was like this linear career that went from here to here to here. But I published my first book last year, Cult Status, which we'll be talking about. And as part of that, I was able to look back and reflect on the last 15, 20 years. And then just pull out threads that I've kind of seen that are obvious now in retrospect, but not at the time.
Gosh, this is such a good segue to my next question, in which I reference a quote from the great Steve Jobs. And it's one of my favorite quotes where he mentions that you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect the dots looking backwards. I love that quote for all of the reasons we have just discussed. However, I wanted to ask you, when you look back at that journey, were there any significant turning points, any moments that you feel really catalyzed the human being, the purpose that you have today?
Great question. I think the most important moment was probably the most innocuous. It seemed the most innocuous at the time. And that was when I was 22, I sent an email to a bunch of my friends, and it said, went to about 20 or 30 people, and it said, hey guys, if you're like me, I'm a bit sick of going to the normal places. I want to launch something that takes us off the beaten track. And the event was called Fag Tag at the time, which was like a funny reference to a bunch of gay and lesbians going tagging in a venue.
I heard you and Lisa chatting about Fag Tag actually on her podcast, Hear Me Roar. And it was, share the story, because I think there's so much to learn from this one.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was an email saying, I'm really sick of going to these normal traditional venues. Because at the time, this was in the early 2000s, they had these amazing, it was like Sydney clubbing scene and nightlife scene was at its peak. You had like Home nightclub and Gas and all of these amazing places. And
Oh my God, the memories.
The memories, yeah, totally. And it was like the scene was amazing. And then I would kind of like leave there at like 2 a.m. in the morning, pre-lockouts, and go to a gay club.
Yeah.
And it was like going back in time. You kind of like the music was daggy and the scenery was daggy. And I was kind of almost from this new generation at the time coming through that was like, why do we need to put up with not amazing and not futuristic looking and not the greatest music? So I launched this thing called Fag Tag and I sent an email out to 20 or 30 of my friends. And I kind of thought that 20 or 30 people would turn up. And I said, hey, let's meet up on Saturday night at Chinese Laundry. It was the very first one we had. And if we all go on Saturday night, then we can fag tag the place. And it almost becomes a verb to kind of to tag a venue. And within a week, about 1,000 people, I said, here's a mailing list to sign up if you're interested in it. And within a week, about 1,000 people had signed up and all turned up on that Saturday night at this club and kind of took it over. And I had this kind of this, that was my first just feeling in your stomach that you are on the right path, that there's something here that's kind of resonating with other people outside of just yourself.
And it sounds like that was quite a visceral experience. And I ask that because the question under that is what can we learn about purpose from that feeling you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, you know, when you just know. You just know.
Yeah. And it's not a cognitive thing. It's not I'm thinking, it's I feel.
Yes.
This is.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was something around, I was at this venue and then all of a sudden surrounded by, let's say, 200 or 300 people who turned up. And just this feeling of kind of community and this feeling of being in the right place at the right time and the feeling of connecting with something that's bigger than just yourself. And I know this sounds like, hey, I put on a party. Let's go put this into you know, I'm not changing the world here, but it was the reason why that was a turning point was because it was the very start of this very winding path that's led me to sitting here today talking to you about purpose and talking about my book.
Yeah.
And it's all because I sent an email to a couple of friends when I was 23 and I could have very easily had not sent that email.
If you were to unlock the process, why that worked in let's say, I don't know, 3 clear steps, whatever, might be more, might be less. What worked about that? Why was that concept so successful that enabled it to shift from an idea into influence?
Yeah, great question again. And it's actually something I'm exploring in my second book, which I'm writing at the moment. I'm deep into it. And the second book's called Killer Thinking.
Yeah.
And it's all about how you take an idea from a good idea, turn it into a great idea, and then turn it into a killer idea. And most ideas kind of are just good ideas. So there might be like the first thought that comes to your head. And the first thought might be, let's get some friends together and go to a club.
Yeah.
You know, that's a good idea. That's what we're going to do on Saturday night. And then how you refine that and bring it to make it a good idea and make it to a killer idea is this really interesting thing that I'm exploring. One common theme that comes up from lots of people I'm speaking to about this is the idea of launching it into a rising tide. So finding a movement or a moment that's happening that's bigger than you and piggybacking off the back of that movement. And for me, the rising tide there was this kind of like rise of the super clubs and stuff in Sydney and the lack of it for the GLBT community at the time. And that was a moment that this power was bigger than me. You know, it would have, if anyone else came along and did the same event, they probably would have had the same outcome. So I think you have to kind of like really be aware of what those global or local movements are happening in your area and
I
launch into
that.
Them.
Yeah, it's a big one, and my mind's going into 1,000 places at the moment. But fundamentally, what we're talking about there, and I have a question about it later, is the shift from macro influence to micro influence. But you've actually almost taken it to another, chunked it down in another way. But it's this idea that you can't own all of one space, so you can't own all of clubbing, but you can own the space between clubbing and the gay and lesbian community.
Totally.
As an example.
I think that's great. And then once you own a space, you can then expand out from there and there. And I like an example of that in the modern era, or like right now, is the entire kind of like conscious consumer, or the rise of sustainability products, or the rise of renewables. That is a huge global movement that's happening right now, this rising tide, and all these companies that are kind of like launching things into the back into it are all launching into that rising tide, and they're going to be the ones that are going to be, you know, propelled forward further than they can just do it themselves.
Yeah, definitely. Gosh, this is playing out in so many ways at the moment. I'm just even thinking about things like, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement is one that comes to mind. And I've just started to notice, because within Future Crunch, we've become very conscious of diversity by design. But as I've been watching ads as well, there's a Specsavers ad, as an example, where I think there's a bride, she forgets her Specsavers, forgets her glasses, ends up in a school auditorium where there's a play on stage. And what I found really interesting was the diversity by design in this ad, where you literally had nearly every race represented in this like small pool of six or seven people, including the bride, who I think she might look African or like, but darker skin, obviously, which even that is breaking down a lot of stereotypes. I know what you're talking about is a little bit different, but again, it's like the rising tide of these big social issues. And then how do we as brands begin to plug into that rising tide in terms of our offering, but in terms of our communication strategies and all of the other aspects of business as well?
Yeah. And there's a reason why they're rising. So they're rising at the moment because there's this kind of cultural force behind them, like the Black Lives Matter or the Stop Asian Hate. There's these big movements that are happening, sometimes globally, sometimes locally, sometimes with, you know, within your own community, there might be their own interpretation of that. But they're powerful. And I think if you can hook into that, something that naturally, you know, you can't just hook into it if you've got no correlation to it, or if you, you know, don't properly believe in it or properly kind of feel that it connects with what you want to do.
Yeah.
But if you can find something that is a rising tide at the moment, you can launch into that. That is part of the reason why we're sitting here talking today.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I can't wait for this book. Definitely. It's one of my favorite topics is that idea of velocity.
Oh, awesome.
You know, and looking at that velocity with the rising tides. But I love that you've taken it down a level and you're not only looking at the velocity, but how do you integrate this with regards to how we drive cult status in businesses, or how we lead, how we change the world, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about how we change the world. Let's continue down
let's
that
do
line
a
of
small
conversation.
Topic.
So I wanted to have a chat about some of the trends that you have referenced in your book, Cult Status, which has a focus on the millennials, because from what I understand, this is a quite a big driving force with regards to why business is fundamentally shifting, the paradigm shifting in business. Now, we are both what I refer to as millennial elders. So that, you know, that makes us qualified to talk about millennial values. But even more significantly, I know that Junkee Media also partnered with Pollinate to conduct one of the largest youth studies in Australian history. So you're quite qualified to talk to this subject. Now, from what I've read, the research discovered trends about the millennials that I'm sure have been discussed many times before today's interview. Around, you know, adaptability to emerging tech and, of course, the changing attitudes towards social impact and conscious consumerism. But there were two ideas that you referenced that I really wanted to unpack further. Firstly, it was the idea that millennials, as we just mentioned, are now turning 40. Didn't say that, but we are coming into our 40s and we'll continue really for the next, probably next 30 years to be in senior level leadership positions, whether that's as founders, co-founders, CEOs, whatever it might be. As a millennial yourself, and based on the research you have gathered, do you think our generation are prepared for the epic task ahead of us?
Yeah, I often joke that I'm the world's oldest living millennial, born in 1980, so the very start of kind of the millennial movement. And I say that jokingly, but it actually gives us a really unique viewpoint on the generation.
Yeah.
Because I've spent my whole life working with millennials, but when we first started 15, 20 years ago, we were just young people. We weren't called millennials.
Yeah.
We were, you know, in our early 20s, and that's just what young people were. And then we moved into, you know, late 20s and into 30s, and now I just turned 40. So I've kind of watched from the top of the generation as it's expanded down. Mm. And the reason why I concentrate on millennials is because over the next 10 years, millennials are going to move into those positions of power all around the world. So you've got one, you've got this changing attitude of most young people. And I concentrate on millennials because my research is in that space. We've spoken to over 25,000 of them over 10 years. Mm. But that doesn't count out anyone older or younger than that. It just kind of says that's the focus, I think, of the dominant generation.
Yeah, the generation that's driving that change. And as you said, stepping into leadership.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the exciting part.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, because for the first time, you've got this change in attitude where most people, but it is centered heavily in millennials, which is, let's say, roughly 25 to 40-year-olds at the moment. Most of them are saying, we want and demand businesses and companies that we work and buy from to do better. We want them to genuinely care about issues that we care about, which the research says is sustainability, is social equality, is gender equality.
Mm.
And then for the first time in history, instead of us being the young people saying, mum and dad, we want you to care about these things, we're now moving into these positions of power.
Yeah.
So we are world leaders on the stage, Jacinda Ardern. We are CEOs of companies, everyone from Evan Spiegel through to Mark Zuckerberg, even though he's a millennial, we may not want him all the time. We are moving into positions of power in politics in Australia, from Deputy Lord Mayor Jess Scully to Alex Greenwich, the member for Sydney. There's just this movement where all of a sudden people who care and give a shit and now being able to say, well, we're in a position of power and we're going to change the laws. We're going to change the way we do business. We're going to change the way that that renewables are run, or the way that electric vehicles need to be done, or the way that solar has to happen.
Mm.
And that is so freaking exciting.
It's so exciting. And again, this is a really great segue to why now is the time for cult status in business. Given we've got millennials not only out there with the money and consuming, but who are also the ones coming into these organisations and going for those influential roles. So before we go further into the conversation, what is cult status?
Yeah, so cult status is about having a community of people who really believe in the passion of the purpose of why you're doing something. Mm. So when a business has cult status, it has this really strong community around it who believes in what they do. Just before we jump into that, I wanted to add one more piece of fuel onto that fire, talking about, which was we've got millennials change in attitude, and then you've got the changing demographics of society, and then the fuel that we're adding to that is COVID.
Yeah.
What
just a little turning point.
Totally. And also this trend that was kind of like there at the moment, which was already combustible.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, we've got this massive globe-tilting event where everything has been turned upside down, and trends that were slowly ticking along have just been massively accelerated.
Mm.
So I wrote my book pre-COVID. And then I had a few months of the first few months. It came out in July last year. So I had the first few months of COVID to rewrite it, luckily, and speak to a lot of the businesses. And I was really concerned that businesses that I'd spoken to that had cult status, so had really strong communities around them, I was concerned that they were going to go under, or that they were, you know, the book was going to be irrelevant. And instead what I found was that the more cult status you had, so the stronger your community, the better suited you were to get through really tough times.
Mm.
I just wanted to add the COVID accelerant that's kind of happened at the moment, which has just made these three trends hitting together even more combustible.
Yeah, well, I mean, earlier in the conversation, I asked you about the turning point. And the reason I asked specifically about that is because in all of the probably thousands of conversations I've had now about purpose, the one pattern that I have found every time is whether it's by choice, many times it's in a crisis, but regardless of what it is, there is usually a turning point that acts as the catalyst for purpose. And that's something I've seen to be true on a personal level, but it's something that we are also, I think, witnessing collectively, is this collective turning point.
Mm.
And when people feel that sense of hopelessness in the sense that you've got all of these social structures breaking down. Like you've got our collective ego breaking down, our economy, our leadership, all of these things come into question. And all of a sudden we're seeing people out there who are really unwell and our livelihood is threatened, our health is threatened. All of these things are super confronting and dissolve ego in the sense that by its very nature, it asks us to look at what's important and what makes us feel a sense of meaning. And I think COVID in many ways is this collective turning point that is actually providing a springboard for purpose-driven business and businesses with cult status. Because when everything comes under threat, when we're in that political straitjacket of, as I said, livelihood threatened, health threatened, personal freedom threatened, the only thing we can do in the middle of that triad is ask ourselves, well, how can I help? How can I heal? How can I build hope? And that is something that cult status speaks directly to.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a lovely way of putting it.
Mm.
I feel like in the past 12 months, we've had to subtract so many things from our lives.
Yeah.
Not we had to, we were forced to subtract things. Mm. So we subtracted travel. We subtracted going to work.
Yeah.
We subtracted hanging out with friends. We subtracted seeing family and friends. And as soon as you take everything away, you realize what's really been missing from your life. And I feel like that is probably the best opportunity that people have is to actually realize where their purpose lies. Because if you stay still long enough and you realize, okay, I actually don't have much and I'm going to now start layering some of these things back. So let's layer domestic travel back in.
Yeah.
Let's layer face-to-face meetings back in. You can start feeling which of those ones are the ones that really give you some kind of extra vibration or some kind of what makes you feel amazing.
Yeah.
And you can realize where your purpose is. So for me, my purpose is I love building communities of people and bringing them together and filling that with stories. That's what I've done with events. That's what I've done with online websites. And when I didn't have that sense of community last year, I really felt it.
Yeah. There was that isolation.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then as soon as you can start bringing that back in, I just started. Now, for me, it was launching the book in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah.
But the book for me is a way of building a community because it's you meet people who think in the same way that you do. And all of a sudden you start collecting different people and you figure out different things to do with them. And that to me is community building doesn't need to be bringing 1,000 people together. It could mean bringing 2 people together.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing. So let's come back then, cult status.
Yes.
Because that's where we were about to dive in.
We were.
Let's define cult status. What does this really mean?
Yeah. So the simplest definition of cult status is a project or a business that has a really strong community around it who all identify with its purpose.
Yep.
So if you build a business, you have a choice when you build something, and this applies either if you're starting a business or if you work in a business or if you're just having a project. And if you launch something, you've kind of got a choice. And the choice is you can create a business that sells shit, that, you know, makes lots of money for you and doesn't really do much else. The money thing is optional. Sometimes you just sell shit and don't make any money. Or you can choose to build something that really clearly says what its purpose is, really clearly knows what impact it wants to have in the world. And other people see that and want to be a part of it, and you start building a community one person at a time around that product or service.
Mm.
And when you start doing that, you build a business or brand with cult status.
So to frame this up a little further, in the book, you actually have a really nice example. And I have to say, having read the book now, it's so beautifully laid out where you've really done the work, not only from the perspective of telling great stories and writing an entertaining book, but you've got some really practical examples and case studies of what we're talking about here. And one of the things you referenced was old thinking versus new thinking.
Mm.
And I think that's a really nice way to explain to people that the tectonic plates that are moving here that really represent an old paradigm in business and a new way of being in business, which really represents what cult status is about. Can you share with me some actual examples of old thinking versus new thinking in business?
Yeah. So old thinking is kind of the way that we are raised, have been raised to think about business.
Yeah.
So it's things like business is all about making money. business is all about 10x in your revenue. Business is all about going, you know, hyper masculine, like this, build it bigger and bigger and better. Bigger is always better. And there's a whole new generation of people coming through who are thinking differently about business. Mm. And this new way of thinking is, well, instead of just thinking about how many widgets I'm going to sell, the new way of thinking is thinking, well, how many people are going to benefit from buying those widgets?
Mm.
So it's almost like kind of changing the way of thinking around being just that old way, which has kind of been driven by lots of things, society, by rich lists, by dragon's dens, you know, things like that kind of drives a lot of it. Well, our whole
economic system really is built around
the
growth,
the stock exchange. Like, they're like constantly going up, 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 up.
Yeah.
And then this new way of thinking is like, well, hold on a second. Is bigger always better?
Yeah.
Is there a better way of thinking about what I'm doing rather than, of course, making money is a part of it, but is there making impact or the effect that you're going to have on someone and bringing that into business? So that's kind of where this whole new way of thinking came about, and that's where the book stemmed from. That was the original thought.
Amazing. So let's dive in, because across the course of the book, you actually unpack 7 steps. So I want to have a bit of a chat about the first step, which was all about starting with think impact first. Now, I've always been a little bit frustrated with the idea that you can give business a purpose, like, you know, you can retrofit purpose. It reminds me a little bit of, you know, when you're walking through, say, Martin Place and somebody runs up to you trying to get you to donate to a charity. And if you don't genuinely care about that charity, you're not going to donate, but you're not going to feel the passion or the fire or any of those things because it's not aligned to your personal purpose. That said, I am a really firm believer that organizations should create a measurable return on impact, but I kind of feel like, let's call it what it is, a return on impact. So I'm, you know, what I wanted to understand is whether you feel there's a difference between purpose and impact, because I sometimes wonder within an organizational context, is that why we get confused about this thing that people call purpose and how do we do it? And is it about understanding my why? And there's this buzzword being thrown around. What is the difference? What is purpose? What is impact? How does it all work?
Yeah, yeah. Big question and good question.
It is.
Because there is a lot of confusion in the space.
Mm.
A lot of times the words are used interchangeably.
Yeah.
And sometimes that makes sense and sometimes it doesn't.
Mm.
So I'll start at the beginning, which was when I was writing the book. I went and spoke to about 50, 60 people all around the world. Pre-COVID, when I could fly over to San Francisco to have coffee with someone and head around to different parts of the world. It was a lovely time. And I sat down with all these people who had really successful businesses.
Mm.
Successful both in terms of monetary and generally in terms of the impact that they were having, in terms of they were, you know, changing supply chains and reinventing a lot of things. And what I realized that all of them had in common was that before they started, before they figured out, okay, I want to sell a shoe, I want to create a makeup brand, almost all of them had figured out, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
So what is the point of this? The simplest thing is of that is what is the impact that I want to have? Sometimes impact and purpose, I think, are interchangeable in that situation. Mm-hmm. Like, what is the purpose of what I'm doing or what is the impact I want to have? I think where it gets a bit confusing is when you start getting up into bigger companies.
Yeah.
So when you start something from scratch, it's easy to do this first step, which is thinking the impact first, because you're doing that first before you do anything else.
Yeah. And I mean, at that point, I imagine there's the layer of it's simple because, you know, if purpose is human, it's the co-founders who are directing the purpose of that company.
Yeah.
So you're not dealing with, say, 200 staff where you're like, I'm going to align your personal purpose to this one grand mission, and it all works like clockwork.
Yeah. And my pet peeve in corporate is where the purpose comes from, like the PR side.
Yes.
Or the CSR, the corporate social responsibility side.
Totally.
When the people at the top or the company doesn't believe it, but they are told, well, everyone's talking about gender diversity at the moment, therefore our purpose is blah, or
yeah,
whatever kind of happens.
Yeah, but are you doing the work?
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. And the only places where I've seen a big company genuinely been able to change and connect with what their purpose is when it comes from the very top down.
Yeah.
So like a CEO level or a great board or a great executive team who firmly believe it. Every single person there, not just saying it. And I think one of the best examples of that is Unilever.
Yeah.
So a huge global company. CEO came on board last year or the year before and said that any of these brands that doesn't have a purpose over the next few years, they're going to get rid of. The proof will be in the pudding for that. Are they really going to stop selling Omo because it doesn't have a purpose? But when the CEO says that, you know that the entire company has to really interrogate that and find out what does that mean for them.
Yeah.
And when you're a big company like Unilever and you say that every brand needs to have a purpose, what I love about that process is he's not saying our purpose at Unilever is that every brand needs to, you know, help body positivity. Mm. He's saying to every leader within that organization, you need to figure out what your purpose is for your section and come back and report to me.
Which I love because there is truth in that.
Yeah.
And to your point, you know, I've always been a firm believer that, as you're saying, purpose isn't a CSR function, it's an HR function.
Mm. Mm. Totally. Yeah, yeah. And so I get a lot of questions around it's obviously easier to think of purpose and to think of impact at the early stages, and that is 100% true. But if you are a bigger company, you can connect to that as long as you do it properly. So I think our job should be convincing CEOs that they need to do that, or training, hopefully, that next generation coming through, which brings us back to what we're talking about earlier, to when millennials and Gen X and Gen Z, when we start becoming to those positions of power, then you've got someone who genuinely believes in that.
Yeah.
And that might be easier than telling an old white man why purpose is important for his company. Might be supporting that next layer down and helping them get into the top jobs.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's so much to think about in this in this conversation, isn't there? But I absolutely agree, and I think that, again, the added layer to that for our generation is the planet. Like, we have less choice about this. It's a big thing. Yeah.
There is. The more you read about it, the more you see. There's an awesome documentary on Netflix at the moment called Coral something.
Yeah.
The Coral something. The Coral Story. It's this amazing documentary, and it's all about the kind of coral bleaching.
Yeah.
And the whole documentary is actually quite simple, is that this guy wanted to set up cameras underwater to watch coral bleaching happening, because he came from an advertising background and he believed that we don't see it at the moment. It happens underwater. And so we actually, what you can't see, you can't change. So he's made this amazing documentary, and I watched it, and my husband and I were sitting there, and we were both in tears at the end.
Yeah.
And we're just realizing that, not just that because that one piece of content, but this, we are in the middle of a ticking time bomb right now. Like, we have 20 to 30 years to unfuck this planet, or it's on us. Like, we are the generation that's sitting here on this earth right now that's probably going to ruin it for the next generation unless we get our fingers out and do something. And that, as a purpose, should really connect to everyone. Like, if you are human and you are enjoying the planet and you like going for walks and you like trees, that should be a purpose that should connect to every single person.
Oh, absolutely. And I think also exploring the intersection between what you're saying, the problem solving, the purpose, but also intelligent optimism. You just reminded me of a documentary I watched about 2 weeks ago called What's Your 2040? And I think the guy's name is Damon Gatow. He's the sugar guy.
Yeah, totally.
He had literally traveled all over the world and found some of the most innovative ideas to solve different problems related to climate action. And what he did was trace out the storyline that if every single one of these ideas were implemented, what would this look like in 2040? So painted the most optimistic picture possible, that if we can execute on everything that we're already doing today, but actually bring it to life, amplify it, if we can amplify all these businesses with cult status, what is the best possible outcome?
Awesome.
And I thought it was such a cool thing to be putting out into the world to inspire the millennials, to inspire us to go, hey, we've got this.
Yeah.
We can do this.
Yeah. Like, and putting a positive spin on it. Like, yeah. As in, I'm an optimist.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean I'm delusional.
Yeah.
It just means that I choose, if there's two things there, to figure out what are the solutions, just like Damien in that doco. What are the solutions that we can focus on rather than what are the drawbacks? Because it's very easy in something like this to just put your head in your hands and be like, I give up. It's too fucking hard. It's not going to work. Whereas instead, I think you need to focus on, okay, what are the things we're actually doing right now? What are the solutions?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's then question all of the small things, which is step two. If we look to the world of influence, we spoke before about this idea of macro influence and that kind of being attached to old thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then we look at this idea of micro influence, where we have this really, targeted audience. What's the connection between a brand with cult status and how they go about really pulling together and having the having the gravity to attract that target audience? I mean, this is something you've had a lot of experience in with both Junkie and Same, I imagine, as
yeah,
well.
Yeah. Yeah. And the simplest answer to that is a curiosity mindset.
Yeah.
So the brands that have cult status are constantly curious. So the people inside there, and they're just asking questions. And so the second step is question all the small things.
Yeah.
And it particularly focuses on small changes that can actually have big outcomes. And it's easy sometimes when you are, this one probably is almost more relevant if you're working in something that already exists.
Yeah.
And you look around you and someone tells you how to do something because it's the way it's always been done. And the brands that are coming through with cult status are the ones that have people inside them that say, hold on a second, why are we doing it that way?
Mm-hmm.
Why have we always done it like that? Is there a better way? A perfect example of that is Who Gives a Crap, the toilet paper brand.
Yep.
I use them as the best example in Australia of a brand that balances profit and purpose together.
Yep.
They donate 50%
of their... They're so good. And it's, you just reminded me, you really get... It's funny, whenever I go into a toilet and there's Who Gives a Crap toilet paper, you get such a good insight into the owner of that 100%. Toilet. I'm like, they're a Who Gives a Crap.
Yeah, totally. And just as Thank You have done over the past 10 years, and you go in there and you see Thank You hand soap, and then you see Who Gives a Crap toilet paper, and you say, this person cares.
This person cares.
Yeah. That they give a crap.
Yeah.
And
which comes to your point of, question the small things, but notice the small things.
Totally. Yeah. And so Who Gives a Crap? They question the small things. So they sell toilet paper, like the most boring item, but necessary item that we buy every single day.
Yeah.
And they questioned, why can't the wrapping that you put on there be beautiful paper that you can reuse to wrap presents up in?
Mm.
Why can't the boxes be, have like giant billboards for them when they sit on your doorstep? Why can't it be a subscription business when we know that everyone goes to the toilet X times a month and therefore you know how much toilet paper you're going through? They just questioned all of these things around the entire process of getting toilet paper from a bland factory into your bathroom.
Mm.
And completely reinvented. And last year they made $12 million in profit, kept $6 million, donated $6 million. That's pretty sweet.
So sweet. And again, the other thing it's a really good example of is the rising tide.
Mm.
You've got this idea of this big thing like toilet paper. And maybe purpose is the one thing that enables you to create that smaller thing that enables you to jump onto the rising tide.
Yeah. And like they've been doing it for 10 years.
Yeah.
I've known Simon the whole time. And when he started, toilet paper was extremely unsexy.
Yeah.
So the tide that he was rising into at the time was sustainability and the fact it was recycled paper. And that was a huge tide that kind of got him over some waves.
Yeah.
And then the COVID tide came and the great toilet paper shortage of 2020 and this huge tide, but they had done the hard work.
Yeah, they were ready.
8 years. Yeah. They were ready.
Yeah.
So it meant that when the massive tide came and they had 500,000 customers on their waiting list, they were able to actually service them all because they'd spent 8 years kind of surfing
preparing for it. Yeah.
Which I think is amazing to kind of to understand as well. Like there was a lot of hard slog so that they could take advantage of an amazing moment that they had no idea was coming.
So what's your advice then for the young entrepreneurs out there, or as we said, the millennials coming into leadership positions? What's your advice for helping them to get clear on that small idea that would enable them to plug into that rising tide?
Yeah, so I think it's about looking at everything around you and questioning. So yeah. Never losing that curiosity mindset, never losing the ability to ask a question in a room. Like, I often say that I think the smartest person in the room is the person who asks the questions.
Mm.
And sometimes they might be the perceived to be dumb questions. Excuse me, I'm putting my hand up. What does that acronym mean?
Yeah.
Excuse me. So why are we selling those things to those people there? Why don't we just do it in this way? They are the smart people in the room. And I think often we can look if there's like a meeting at work and there's like 10 people sitting around and that one person who might be annoying in the corner asking the questions, they're the ones who kind of have that curiosity mindset. And so I'd say to anyone listening, just look around at every single thing that you're doing, from the smallest things, and ask questions about them.
Yeah.
And in the book, I have a really simple matrix in one of the exercises, the IRL exercise at the end of each chapter, which I love because I'm a very practical person. I like to like get inspired and then get out a pen and like write things down.
Yeah.
And there's a really...
And you have an amazing purpose playbook on your website too. Just while we're here, I'm going to send people that way.
Yes, awesome. Yeah. There's this really simple matrix which just has asking things about small questions and large questions, and then whether they have a big impact or a small impact.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to find is those things that are the small questions that have a big impact. And there are probably so many of them if you actually look around your own business.
Yeah. I need to go and check that out myself, I think. So what I want to talk about now is our superpowers. Mm. Now, we spoke a little bit before about the reason this podcast is called The DNA of Purpose, in that I have some of my own process that links the idea that purpose is a little bit like our DNA. It's unique. It's something that we inherit, something that evolves, has epigenetic factors, all of those sorts of things. So with all of that in mind, I'm really curious to understand, in your experience, how do people get clear on what their superpowers are? Is it something that we are born with? Is it something that we master? What's the process?
Yeah. And so refining your superpowers is the third step.
Mm.
And it is really around... Sometimes we don't know what our superpower is that needs to be revealed to us.
Yeah.
And other times it's really damn obvious. And I found the best way is of trying to remove yourself from it. I think if you asked me 5 years ago, Tim, what's your superpower? Like, oh, I don't know. I'm good at PowerPoint. It's actually quite hard to know what it is.
Mm.
And I found the best way is kind of asking people around you or being intuitive enough to pick up on what people around you say.
Yeah.
So if you know, we're the worst judges of ourselves. We have internal voices that go on. We have imposter syndrome. We don't see all these things that other people can see. Whereas other people might be like, you know what? You are amazing at connecting other people together. And you're like, oh, I just something that I do. I just kind of like bringing people together. And if you ask your friends and family around you, your work colleagues, you can do it in a formal way or just even in an informal way. Very soon you can kind of pick up on where the common themes come out. That's one part. That's one way. Another way is also just being more in tune with how you are feeling and kind of starting to recognize throughout your day, if you're doing 10 things that day or that week, start writing down and recognizing where are those moments when you feel most alive.
Yeah.
Are they when you are doing spreadsheets, or are they when you are playing with your kids, or are they when you are at dinner telling an amazing story to your friends?
Absolutely. And I think that comes back to what we referenced earlier in the conversation about purpose as a visceral experience.
Mm.
It's very easy to talk about purpose as being like a statement of why, but actually the experience of purpose is an energy in motion. It's a feeling. It's that those moments of joy, of expansion, where we're like, this is who I am.
Yeah, definitely. So I think that visceral thing, and the reason why there's lots of different ways of figuring this out is because everyone is different. Some people are really in touch with that visceral feeling inside their stomach and act on it. Other people have spent their entire lives pushing that down into the pit of their stomach so they don't have to deal with it.
Well, yeah, because there's a truth required.
Oh, there really is. Yeah. I first felt that when I was about 20 or something, and I used to catch the ferry to work in my advertising job. And there was one day where I was catching the ferry to work, and the closer I got to work, this knot in my stomach just got tighter and tighter and tighter.
Mm.
And I got into work that day and I quit. I had no job to go to. I was young, so I kind of luckily didn't have to worry too much about that. My life was pretty cheap back then. But I just had the ability to recognize this is not how you should be feeling. I didn't quite know what it was. It was this gut feeling. Acted on it. And then a week after that, I got my first full-time job in writing.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know that that job was going to be out there.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how much, if you can like listen to that visceral feeling in your stomach, it can tell you things.
Totally. I mean, and there's science that backs this stuff. You know, when you're talking about, you know, gut health and serotonin and the link that has to our brains, but also heart intelligence, like there are more messages being sent to our brain from our heart than the other way around, more neurons.
Mm.
And the only reason I reference that is because if we start to think that way, we realize that there are so many different layers of intelligence with regards to how we hear and integrate the world around us, that it's not all about just what we think about something.
Mm. Yeah, great.
So let's have a chat about what it means to have an alter in business, which is the next step.
Yeah.
In the book, you said this: to build a cult business, you need to have an altar. This is somewhere all the people who love your product, service, or mission can come together with other followers and focus their energy at the same time. So my question is this: in an age where we have so many altar options in the digital and real world, what process would you recommend a business or a brand go through to identify the most effective and influential altar?
Yeah. So define your altar as the, what are we up to, fourth step
I think
now?
We're up to number four.
Yeah, great. Yeah. I wrote the damn book. But anyways,
we're traversing.
Yeah, yeah.
We're getting there.
Define your altar. I love this step because this is the one that most people don't think about.
Mm.
They don't think consciously about it. And I think go back 20 years ago, an altar needed to be a physical place. So if you were a store, if you were the body shop, you sold things, people came into your store. You were like, okay, that's where people come. If you were an events business, people came along to the event that you do.
Mm-hmm.
And with the rise of social media and the ability for people to congregate online virtually with each other, it opened up this entire new area for people to be able to get together. And this is, as per our earlier conversation, there is a real power in getting people together.
Mm.
There is an extra energy that comes when you bounce off each other and you have a room full of buzzing people, or it could be two people in a room, whatever it is. And the rise of social media has allowed businesses and anyone really to have a digital altar. So it could be an amazing forum. So In the Mix and Same in my early days were built on forums.
Yep.
They were digital altars where tens of thousands of people would turn up every Monday morning and talk about what happened on the weekend.
Mm.
And that was an altar. So for a business now, I think the simplest way is to think through the behavior of your users. Watch them. It could be your clients. It could be people that buy your product or service, or if you're a professional service, it could be people that come to you for information. And watch what they do and see, is there anywhere that they currently congregate that you can own? So,
is this something you have done using analytics in the past? Like, how are you going about that process? I mean, obviously it's conversations and talking to people,
yeah,
but when you're dealing with something like a digital media platform.
Yeah, there's a lot of observation that goes on, to be honest. This one is probably a bit of hunch mixed with a bit of observation.
Right.
Less analytics. So when we had Junkie, for example, we had a couple of different altars or places where the people who read Junkie would come together. There was things like Facebook groups and Facebook pages and Instagram pages. They're okay as a digital altar. If you have a really good one and a really strong community and it's really well moderated, that can be amazing. But there's also a lot of danger with that because people aren't that committed to it because it might just appear on their Facebook feed. But we consciously decided a few years ago, we launched this event called Junket, which was Junkie's kind of one of our first real world events where we brought together a couple of hundred people, put them into a hotel in Canberra and said to them, we're having a conference, but it's an unconference and we want you guys to come up with the agenda. Go.
I read about the Unconference in the book.
Yes, yeah. And it was this really amazing event where at the first session, anyone could stand up and had 60 seconds.
I have to say, it sounds like an event planner's nightmare.
Oh, my God. It was, you had to relinquish all control.
Yeah.
So imagine we had 200 people, we had an opening session, and anyone could stand up, and there was a counter on stage for 60 seconds and say, "Hi, my name's Tim, and I want to talk about mental health in the digital world and why it's important." We write that idea up on a board. And that becomes a session. So the next day, whoever is interested in that session comes and meets you and talks about it. And we did that. And we had about 100 different sessions over the couple of days. And the way that that brought to life what Junkie was,
yeah,
and all of our values and the inclusion and diversity and messiness and everything that involves the Junkie world, we brought that together in a real space. And those events to this day have changed me in a way.
Mm.
And they've changed everyone who came along to those events. I met my book publisher there. There were laws that were enacted off the back of it. There were businesses that were founded. There were books that were written. And that is a great example of finding and defining what our altar was and bringing it to life.
Totally. There's so many lessons in that. I mean, people talk about collaboration a lot and they talk about diversity by design a lot. But what I'm hearing from you is that altar enabled you to literally craft a narrative from groupthink.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. Yeah, yeah. And diversity by design.
And diversity by design.
We went through that and said we're sick of hearing from the same people. So we paid for everyone to come there.
Yeah.
We had it sponsored.
Yeah.
So we could have people from the country. We could have people from outside of Sydney. We could have lots of diverse voices. We could have women and men coming together in similar numbers. We could have racial diversity. We could have Indigenous population. There was this real diversity of thought, and it was like nothing on earth. And we repeated it for 3 years. And so 600-700 people kind of came through that event. And it was just one of the best things that we've done, we ever did.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. There you go. Define your altar. So, Tim, I want you to talk to me about the significance of these two bylines, know your enemy and know what you are not. Sounds easy, but I'm guessing kind of complex when you're in an adaptive and fast-moving marketplace with a sea of competition.
Yeah, know your enemy sounds so evil now. It's like, know who your enemy is. And when I write about it in the book, I talk about an enemy as a thing or a concept, not necessarily a person.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that, although there is some benefit to competition, and we always had a really healthy competition, and I wouldn't call them enemy, but with other publishers, know your enemy is kind of like, what are you fighting against?
Mm.
So what is that concept that you're fighting against? And is that, in terms of the environment, sustainability, is that too much plastic usage?
Yeah.
Is that the old companies that dominate the space. Think of Dollar Shave Club is a really good example in that, who their enemy was the Gillette. And
yeah,
it's kind of like those big companies have been around for 100 years and hadn't innovated in the right way.
The case study that you used in the book that I read yesterday, which I loved, was Melanie Perkins from Canva. It's such a good example of sort of defining Photoshop as the enemy and going, well, how can we do that better? So it's not always the competition.
Yeah.
But the system.
The system. Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. And I think sometimes, so when it's an enemy that's big and bad and ugly and everyone agrees with it, it makes your job easier.
Yeah.
Because you're kind of fighting against something that, you know, a big enemy that lots of people have.
Yeah.
So yeah, for her, it was the kind of like the concept that, oh my God, you used to have to take courses to learn how to do Photoshop.
Yeah.
And Canva, you can like go online and figure it out in half a minute. So I think, yeah, having an enemy that is something that you can fight against is really important.
Yeah.
And in the same time, it's also knowing what you don't stand for.
Well, that I find that one's interesting because I think that's a lot more difficult. Again, particularly when we're in markets that are so competitive and so adaptive, it is really easy. And I think this is true for purpose as well, that idea of being on purpose or off purpose or knowing what to say yes to or no to. It's very easy to lose your anchor if you're letting everything that's around you dictate who you are.
Oh, completely. Completely, yeah. I think if you it's easy to say what you are, and that can expand, and you can just kind of keep going, and you can be, so let's say, example, if you are a brand and you say, here's what I stand for. I am cheap and accessible.
Yeah.
Right. And that for some brands, that's a thing. And then if you keep going with that, it can be, okay, so I'm cheap, therefore I'm discounted. Then I'm accessible, therefore I'm available everywhere. Therefore, everywhere you look, I mean, every supermarket. And if you can kind of keep going with that and lose sense of who you are, whereas if you define what you're not, so you can say that I am cheap, but I'm never discounted. And that all of a sudden puts a line in the sand.
Yeah.
Or you can say I'm accessible, but I'm accessible only in high-end stores.
Mm.
So by kind of saying what you are and what you are not, you really, I think, help define the difference between the two. An example of that is I spoke to Toby Pierce, who co-founded Sweat with his partner at the time, Kayla Itzinas. And the two of them launched Sweat, this amazing multi-million dollar, I think they made $100 million in revenue last year, all from Adelaide, an online app. And the two of them kind of built their brand together, and Kayla is kind of the face of it.
Mm.
And they have really defined together what Sweat stands for and what Sweat isn't, and what Kayla's brand stands for and what it's not, and what the other trainers stand for. And it's just a really nice way, I think, of, you know, all of us also have a personal brand, and figuring out what your personal brand is and what it isn't is really important.
Totally. And I think, again, nice segue to my next question, because that was where I was actually going to go. But to come back to what you were just saying, I don't think really, I mean, I can't remember over the course of being in business or running businesses ever actually sitting there and asking myself what I'm not.
Mm.
I've spent a lot of time asking myself what I am and how I craft that narrative. But I just think for any business owner, that is a super powerful process to go through.
It really is. And the two of them are not just opposites.
Mm.
So it's not just saying, because I am something here, I'm the opposite over here.
Yeah.
Sometimes you actually might come across something and you say, well, I'm definitely not that. And that might really illuminate something that you hadn't actually seen before that you definitely are. And I think it's really useful to do that also in the context of your competition. So you can look around and say someone and be like, I do not want to be what they are doing over there. And therefore that helps you define what you are.
Mm. So obviously they have pretty compelling influencer brands. And what I wanted to have a chat about is this idea that due to digitization and social media platforms, that people follow people over brands. And when we're looking at businesses with cult status, ultimately they're businesses that have some focus on solving a human problem of some description. So in terms of buying into that brand, I think a big part of that interaction is that we as the consumers trust the human voice behind the brand, that they're doing what they say they will do, that they have integrity. And in a sense, that's something that can only come from the human being.
Mm.
So in terms of a marketing strategy, what is your advice with regards to how you go about humanizing a message?
Yeah, I think the best brands either are started by people that you know and take on some of their
DNA.
Yeah, totally. Or they have people at the top who you learn to understand, who represent some of their values.
Mm.
And the companies that don't do that and are just faceless are the ones I think are going to really struggle over the next few years.
So you do think this influencer strategy, and I'm not just talking about your marketing influencers with lots of likes on Instagram. I'm talking about thought leaders, business influence, that this is a core strategy with regards to how you take a purpose-driven business out into the world.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I think you need, for certainly anyone who's in the media or anyone who represents the brand, to really represent the same values and the human side of that brand.
Yeah.
A great example of that is Alan Joyce, who is
Qantas,
the CEO of Qantas.
Yeah.
And he was out so far in front of the marriage equality debate, both as a human, because he's married to his partner and been with him for a gazillion years, and as a company. And he took serious flack for that. So he was pied in the face. Someone came up to him in the face and came up to him at a conference in Perth and put a pie in his face because they didn't agree with his stance on marriage equality. He has been kind of humiliated over that. He was ahead of the curve in terms of all the corporate backing that kind of came out for marriage equality. Mm. He was doing it 5-10 years before that. And that is an amazing example of you then feel better about the brand Qantas because here is someone who's standing up for what they believe in.
Yeah.
I think Gail Kelly is another great example when she ran Westpac and her really push for diversity in her leadership team and as one of the few very high-profile female CEOs in the country, she just had an amazing kind of take on that that really, if you know the company, kind of like waterfalled all the way down to the company and is still being felt there today.
Yeah, I mean, they're great examples. But, I mean, even just on in the simplest way, you know, a brand can't do a podcast. A brand can't deliver a keynote.
Totally.
A brand can't write an article. There, you know, that there is just in a really pragmatic sense, human beings are the brand because there's only so many things the brand can do and act for.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think it's easy for a founder to reflect that and more difficult for, you know, someone who's hired in to reflect that.
Yeah.
But it certainly can be done and it needs to be done.
Definitely, definitely. So in the book, you had referenced a quote by Lady Gaga, who is amazing, by Lady Gaga and her little monsters. And what she said is, so the real truth about Lady Gaga fans, my little monsters, lies in this sentiment. They are the kings, they are the queens, they write the history of the kingdom, and I am something of a devoted jester. Talk me through the significance of these words.
Yeah, so number one, I love Gaga.
I know, right?
I used to run a nightclub in Sydney called Nevermind, which was on Oxford Street. And when Lady Gaga came to Sydney, that was the club that she did her secret performance
in.
Oh,
my gosh. What a moment for you.
Yeah, which was a phenomenal experience. I remember greeting her as she got out of her car and like the back door and helping her up the stairs. And she was dressed like Miss Havisham from Great Expectations. And she got kind of like a jilted widowed bride with this like big veil on top of her. And I remember walking her up the stairs and I was like, Gaga, are you going to wear this to perform on stage?
Yeah.
And she was like, no, darling, this is just my arrival outfit. Which is amazing.
Know, first impressions count. Not that she needed one.
Yes. So Gaga, she's kind of been a personal hero of mine. And the way that she built her community of fans, her little monsters, as she kind of referred to them. And it was seeing people who aren't seen. Mm. And she really kind of like represented almost. She was kind of like the anti-pop. You know, there was like Madonna there and there's Kylie and there's Britney.
Yeah.
And she was kind of like this person who was, you know, normal, and she was a bit fractured and she was not perfect. And, you know, she kind of represented, I think she's kind of called them like freaks and geeks and stuff like that. Like people who were a little bit left of center.
Yeah.
And I just love that the way that she talks about her community is she's not the leader of it. They tell her where to go and she kind of follows along to them. And that's kind of what that chapter of the book, which is called Lead from the Middle, is all about. This idea that if you connect with people and you can really clearly explain what your purpose is and someone else connects with that, then they will lead you and take you places that you may not even know you're going to go to yourself, as opposed to you saying, right, everyone follow me, we're going over here, and then people just walking behind you.
Yeah.
So that
it's almost as if your job is to translate rather than lead. My job is to listen, to know your questions, to know your needs and to integrate them so that I can translate that into a language that you all connect with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a really nice way of putting it. Mm. Yeah, and I think Gaga does that beautifully.
Yes, I did. I had a vision of her in her grand outfit in the middle of a big circle with all these monsters.
Totally, yeah, yeah. I tried hard to find quotes that were really different and unusual for this book.
Yeah, yeah.
And so just putting Gaga in there, I might try and see if I can find another Gaga quote for the second book too.
Oh, look, I'm sure she's got some pearlers.
She does.
She's a pretty amazing woman.
She is a phenomenal woman.
Her documentary was incredible.
Incredible. Yeah, 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 totally. She's and just real and honest and I just love that. I think sometimes when people think that they have fans like Gaga has or has a community around them, like I use the example of Beyonce for this.
Yeah.
Like as in Beyonce is kind of like the head. She's called Queen Bee.
Yeah.
She's like the head of her community. I don't necessarily know if she leads from the middle because I don't think she kind of co-creates as much with the community as someone like a Gaga does.
I mean, Gaga's not, I find, you know, obviously love Beyonce, but there's an aloofness.
There is. There's a separateness.
Where in a conversation about cult status, you're like, Gaga gives a shit. She's got cult status.
Yeah.
She cares more about those monsters than who buys her records.
Totally.
Or, like,
yeah, yeah.
And you and know that. Like,
yeah. And that's part of the next part, which I'm sure we're going to talk about in a little bit, which is around drop the bullshit.
Yeah.
Which is one of the next steps, which is just being real and honest and connecting with people. And someone like a Lady Gaga does that, and her documentary does that. And there's a lot of, you know, pop stars or musicians or just anyone coming through who are really honest about their process.
Yeah.
And so please don't hate me, Beyonce stans. Please don't come after me because I said that she's not as amazing. We're just talking about her aloofness.
Well, we're talking about her leadership style.
Her leadership style, exactly. Yeah.
Doesn't mean she is
please,
not the queen bee
no
on stage.
No angry tweets.
So, yeah, let's talk about drop the bullshit, though, because I am curious to unpack this a little bit. We hear a lot these days about this idea of authenticity in business or authenticity in leadership, but the reality is at some level we still need to show up and get a job done. And what I mean is, like, when you go to the GP needs to make sure that they look after whatever is wrong with you. They can't burst into tears and say, I'm having a really crap day, but I'm being authentic.
Totally.
So how do we navigate this idea of drop the bullshit, but still understand that our role is to show up, to lead, to do what we need to do? Like, what's the line
yeah,
there?
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a difference between being authentic and oversharing.
Yeah.
And being authentic just means, you know, both in a business sense and on a personal level, are you actually communicating how you feel about something, but obviously tempered?
Yeah.
So you're not going to, you know, if you're having a really, really shit day, you can say to someone, yeah, I'm having a shit day. And then get on with doing what you need to do instead of wallowing in it and being like, therefore, I can't do anything else today because I'm having a really shit day. And I think that we are starting to see that more both from, you know, on social media. The kind of like the perfect Instagram facade is kind of less fetishized, for want of a better term these days. And it's more about people who are real and honest. And I think brands also drop the bullshit kind of means being transparent as you can about how things are made, where the money goes, what's your supply chain, what do you do once someone buys something. So drop the bullshit is kind of about just being as honest and transparent as you can, but obviously there's limits to that if you're a doctor.
Yeah, drop the bullshit or don't be a shit person, basically.
Don't be a shit person. Yeah, totally. And hopefully when someone does drop the bullshit, they're not a shit person.
Yeah.
If someone drops the bullshit
and you're like,
well,
we didn't want to see that.
Then find a different friend.
Yeah. So as we sort of close, I've got two more questions, just so you know. I do like long, deep and meaningful. Podcast is good for that. But we've spoken a lot about, you know, some of the interesting aspects of business and the shiny aspects of business and marketing and influence and all of that stuff. I now want to have a bit of a chat about what I call the F-bombs. And the F-bombs are the, you know, the failures, the fear, what I call fake news, which is all the mindset stuff. Like, what's the story you tell yourself about who you are, and when that's really crap, how do you shift that? And underneath all of that, as an entrepreneur, how do you forgive yourself and keep moving when things go wrong? What are your thoughts about these F-bombs, and how have you navigated?
That's nice. I really enjoy the F-bombs.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. They're all there. I have them all.
The other common thing, so as well as speaking to all these successful people who said they want to think about why they're doing something first, the other thing that was common in every single person I spoke to was as soon as I said to them, tell me about the time you fucked up or what was your failures? They just couldn't stop. As in, every single one of them had a laundry list. They're like, how long have you got? Because the reality of running a business, and the reason why I called the final step strap yourself in, is it's really fucking hard.
Yeah.
There are so many ups and downs. And a really lovely quote was from Michael Fox in there, who started a startup called Shoes of Prey that went on
I know
to,
Shoes of Prey.
Shoes of Prey, yeah. They went on to raise something like $50 million and they went bust. And then he started a new company, and he talks about that. And he said when he came from Google and when he started doing entrepreneurship, the highs were higher than anything he'd ever experienced in his life, and the lows were lower than anything he experienced with his life. So just the undulatingness became huge. And so it is a ride. You need to strap yourself in. And there are so many fuck-ups along the way. There are so many failures. Like I think I gave an example in the book of a night that we ran called the Fuck Up Club, which was where you introduce yourself to people, and instead of saying, "Hi, my name's Tim and I've written a book," it's, "Hi, my name's Tim and I fucked up when I used to work in an ad agency, and we filmed an entire commercial over in Fiji and used the Wilson copyright from Tom Hanks's Castaway as a prop in an ad. And then came back and realized that we didn't have legal approval to do it and had to Photoshop the entire thing out and the ad didn't make sense." And that's how I fucked up.
Yeah.
What's your fuck up? So I think introducing yourself and realizing that every single person has those failures and those fuck ups.
Totally.
And you need to learn from them, because otherwise it will kill you.
Totally. And again, the Steve Jobs quote comes to mind, that you can't connect the dots looking forward, only looking back. And interestingly, with time and perspective, I'm not saying this is always true in the moment, but I think often you look back and you realize that those fuck-ups were actually a diversion to put you on the path you needed to be on, or because there was some bit of information or wisdom or something you needed to pick up.
Totally.
To get from point A to B.
Yeah. And I think the other thing I realized in running a business was the line between success and failure is so thin.
Mm.
So we came really close to almost losing the company several times over the years. You know, when we had 50 employees, 60 employees, and then a real massive fuck up happened and we realized that we hadn't paid the tax office for an entire period because of an accounting problem, and you're millions of dollars behind. You need to go to your investors and get more money. And if you don't get it within 7 days, you
then
go
the
under.
Fuck up is really fucked up.
Yeah. And stuff like that happens over the years. And you realize that anytime I spoke to someone, I tried to speak to people in the book that had businesses that hadn't worked as well as people that had worked, because sometimes you can focus too much on the success stories without talking about the failure stories. And that line between success and failure is so thin, and the people that try and fail should be celebrated just as much as the people that try and succeed.
Mm, absolutely. That's so important. So I've come to my last question today, and what I'm wanting to know, you're someone who's spent, you know, probably more than two decades writing. So my question for you is, at this particular point in human history, what story do you think needs to be told and needs to be heard in order to create a more peaceful and more abundant future for the people and the planet?
Wow, big question to finish on. I think the story that needs to be told now is a more representative story. I feel like the story of our country has been very one-sided, and what we are seeing now is this real diversification in who can tell the stories and how they're told and what stories are told. And I think that is probably the most important cultural and societal movement of our generation. And it's wonderful to kind of see and hear new stories coming out, not just old white straight men telling their stories, who have kind of been running our country for, they certainly run politics, they certainly run business, for almost since our country was born 200 and something years ago, has been run by old white men, old white straight men. And all of this diversity of stories that are coming through now and people telling those stories, whether it's more female representation, whether it's more LGBT, whether it's more Black Lives Matter, whether it's more Indigenous stories, that diversity that reflects who we actually are as a country, that is the story that needs to be told.
We need to unconference ourselves.
We do. We do.
we have
an unconference and unfuck the story that we tell about ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. And ultimately, that is the story that will change the world.
It really will. Yeah. It really will. I think just more diverse stories actually reflecting who we are.
Yeah, definitely. Where can we buy Cult Status?
Yeah. So the simplest way is just head to cultstatus.com.
Yep.
There you will find, you can buy the book, you can read about it, you can download worksheets. You can see what some lovely people have said about the book and get any details and contact me as well if anyone's interested in hearing more about it.
Absolutely. And as I said, there is a great ebook on your website as well, cultstatus.com. I can personally attest to the fact that having read the book, it is a must read for any leader looking to really pioneer a new future that we all want to be a part of. Then you need to pick up this book.
Awesome. Thank you.
Awesome. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the podcast today. Thank you so much.
I've really enjoyed it, Rebecca. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for joining us on the podcast. If you'd like to follow along, please do at the DNA of Purpose on Instagram. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is the DNA of Purpose with Rebecca Tapp. And if you'd like to keep up to date with all of our team's news and events, you can jump onto my website, which is rebeccatapp.com. That is rebeccatapp with two P's.com. Also, if you love what we do, then please do leave us a review. It would be greatly appreciated. Or if you'd like to share your inspiration with our team, we'd love to hear from you. Please do reach out, say hi at your favorite social media hangout.